From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. NASA is looking at new ways to keep astronauts from aging on long flights, maybe to Mars. They could work for the rest of us, too. No one is paying more attention these days than the moguls of Silicon Valley. They've got piles of money and a will to live a long, long time, maybe forever. This hour, On Point, taking on aging and the Silicon Valley drive to make death optional. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you want to live forever? Can Silicon Valley money and brains make it happen? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's look first today, before we turn to Silicon Valley, at the treatment that has caught NASA's attention. Joining me now is David Sinclair, professor and co-director of Harvard Medical School's Lab for the Biology of Aging. David Sinclair, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
What is it that you've got going on that NASA is so interested in, and why?
Well, we've been studying aging for the last 20 years, and we've been trying to figure out what it is that makes us grow old and what we can do to actually reverse that. And we found some interesting molecules that we think have the capacity to reverse aging in people, but we didn't actually expect that we would have applications for NASA, but NASA put out a request for, actually it was a competition, how could we protect astronauts going to Mars? And we need to do that because they're hit with cosmic radiation and they'll eventually get cancer, among other aging effects. And so our idea was to use the same technologies that we're trying to develop here on Earth up in space, and they really liked it. We ended up being one of the winners of that competition.
What's the technology that you've got going? How does it work? What does it do, David?
Well, the way to think about this is that our bodies are very good at healing themselves, but that goes down as we get older. And we all know this. There are some people who live very long and some people who never get sick until very late. And we're trying to find out what's behind that. And what we've discovered as a field is that there are protective mechanisms in our cells that we can kick into action somewhat by exercising and staying thin. But we've actually discovered that there are ways that we could actually use a pill to jog these even better than exercise and diet would do alone.
You're talking about what? Using the metabolite NAD, NAD plus? What is it? How's it work?
So NAD is a molecule that, if you learned about it in high school, it was probably the most boring molecule you've ever read about. It was discovered by the Germans about 100 years ago, and it's essential for all chemical, well, most chemical reactions in the body to be efficient. Without it, you're dead in 30 seconds. But what's been really interesting over the last few years is the discovery that this molecule, NAD, is essential for health as well and seems to control our longevity as well. And as we get older, the problem is that our bodies make less and less of it. By the time you're 50, you have about half the levels you once had in your 20s. And what we're working on now is how do we replenish that NAD molecule so that the body rejuvenates and is as healthy as it was when you were in your teens and 20s.
You're talking about starting human trials of this within 6 months. This seems imminent. I mean, how close are we to a pill that would have everybody regenerating into what we have thought of as old age?
Well, we're certainly closer than we have been for the last 10,000 years. And we certainly, it seems like it's just around the corner. And it's true that we are aiming within the next 6 months to have our first safety trials, actually here in Boston. And we've been working diligently for the last 4 years here in Boston at a local company called Eden Rock Pharma. And this company has been developing molecules that are safe and hopefully effective in people. And we'll know pretty shortly, hopefully within the next year, if we're on the right track. That doesn't mean that we'll be able to give it away yet or even sell it. We still have a number of years to go, but I could see within the next 5 years that we could potentially have a drug that your doctor could prescribe for one disease, say diabetes, but also would protect you against the five other major causes of death and therefore extend your healthy lifespan.
What's the promise here? Is it an extension of lifespan? And this gets to some of the Silicon Valley debate. Or does it extend so far as thinking about, I mean, if you've got something that will constantly repair your body, maybe death is off the table.
Well, I'm not an immortalist. I don't think, at least for the foreseeable future, that we're going to be living forever. But I do see that it's not that difficult, at least based on our animal studies, to extend lifespan by 5 or 10%, which is a big deal. Extending the lifespan of United States population by just 3 years would save about $7 trillion in the long run. And this is money.
$7 trillion in medical treatment costs? Or what's the savings come from?
Well, to the yes, exactly. So you're getting to a good point, which is that we're not just talking about keeping people around for longer. It would be that people would be in their 90s, in reaching 100, and still be productive members of society like they were when they were in their 30s and 40s, being able to play tennis, look after the great-grandkids. And so it's not about keeping people in nursing homes for longer. It's actually about, it's the opposite. It's keeping people out of nursing homes and dying relatively quickly and hopefully painlessly as well.
And just before we turn to Silicon Valley, I want to come back to NASA for a second. So they're interested in this because if this works, this therapy might help their astronauts stay healthy. I'm reading here. I mean, maybe you can confirm it. It says, even on short missions, astronauts experience accelerated aging from cosmic radiation, suffering from muscle weakness, memory loss, and other symptoms when they return. On a trip to Mars, the situation would be far worse. 5% of the astronauts' cells would die, and their chances of cancer would approach 100%. That's a pretty strong incentive, David Sinclair.
Well, it is, and it's actually one of the biggest problems on a Mars mission that hasn't yet been solved. We know how to get to Mars with rockets. That technology pretty much exists. The problem is that you need to shield the spacecraft with about 2 feet of lead or 10 meters of water, which is just not going to happen. It's too heavy, for example. So what we've decided to attempt is instead of shielding the spacecraft, we can shield the genome. And that's the technology that we're talking about. This NAD molecule boosts the body's ability to repair DNA and fight the effects of aging that is they're accelerated on the way to Mars because of the cosmic radiation.
And human trials underway maybe within 6 months on a therapy that might do just that. I want to bring this back down to Earth. David Sinclair with Harvard Medical School, please stand by. We're going to go in just a moment to Tad Friend. He's been in Silicon Valley going very deep on the obsession, I think it's fair to call it there lately, among some of the wealthiest citizens of Silicon Valley with extending life, perhaps permanently extending life, that is, making death optional. Lots of big names in Silicon Valley looking at this the way you'd look at any other kind of technical challenge. Here's a little tape from a couple of years back. This was at the Web Summit in Dublin, Ireland. Billionaire co-founder of PayPal, Peter Thiel, was asked about what in technology was exciting him. His answer, solving aging.
The big theme that I think we could be spending more on is solving the question of aging. Is can we treat aging itself like a disease that can be slowed or possibly reversed? And I think we've not even scratched the surface in asking questions about it because it's very underexplored. What causes people to age? Why does it happen? What could you do about it?
Peter Thiel there, and he's not the only one by any means in Silicon Valley who is, I think it's fair to say, obsessed with this issue. They've got a lot of money. They've got a lot of brain power. A lot of it's being focused on reversing aging or making death optional is a phrase that comes up. Tad Friend joins us right now from New York. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker. Headline on his latest piece is Silicon Valley's Quest to Live Forever. Tad Friend, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Can you give us a sense, before we get into the details, just of the kind of culture and mindset that you found has Silicon Valley so focused on this front?
Yeah, the mindset, I would say, is a sense that finally, maybe even in the last 5 years, solving death or at least, I mean, obviously, as David mentioned, there's two ways to go. There's sort of the idea of increasing our health span, making us live longer, healthier lives, but still with an endpoint. And then there's the people, many of whom come from the tech world, who think, actually, why do we need to have an endpoint? Why can't we just go on forever? Wouldn't that be better all around? And that idea, which is, you know, has always seemed in the realm of science fiction, I think has become something that a number of people in Silicon Valley think is now achievable, although obviously extremely difficult. And I think in the last 5 years, they feel like it's become something that's not only achievable in a theoretical way, but actually fundable, which is a big difference. You can put your money behind it and expect to see a return at some point down the line, a return both financial and, of course, in terms of being around forever to enjoy it. And that's an interesting and exciting mindset. It's also one that many of the scientists in the field are nervous about because they think it's a kind of overpromise and they think they really can't deliver it.
And yet, if you look at this culturally, the microculture of Silicon Valley, and particularly some of its wealthiest residents,
Many of them have history with tech companies who have done things people didn't think were possible or hadn't thought of before. They've made a lot of money with that. They're used to getting their way, and their life is pretty appealing. You can see why they might want to extend it a long time, maybe forever, Ted.
Yeah, one scientist I spoke to said that there's a sort of narcissism behind it, which is the perennial complaint of rich people that I have all this money and I'm not going to live forever. That's a sort of negative way of looking at it. I think the more positive, optimistic way of looking at it is that a lot of people in tech view the human body in a different way than most scientists do. Scientists tend to see it obviously as a biological substrate, an extremely complex system. And as David was mentioning earlier, here's a potentially exciting treatment, but we have to go through clinical trials. There will obviously be unexpected side effects, the reverses. That always happens. The people in tech look at that and say, no, actually, let's look at the body more as a as a technological substrate, something that's almost like a computer operating system that we can upgrade and we can apply new apps to, and we can treat as something that's subject to exponential curves rather than linear curves. And maybe, we upload our brains into the cloud, and maybe we, achieve consciousness in another body, a robot avatar of some kind. We don't have to hang around in our, sad carcasses forever. And that's an interesting way of looking at it. It poses a number of technological hurdles, but it's an interesting sort of theoretical way of looking at it, and it's a big divide between whether people want to see us, simply having compressed morbidity, or whether they want us to live forever.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Silicon Valley's obsession with super longevity, maybe immortality, the high-tech, super-rich, who want to make death optional. Tad Friend has written about it for The New Yorker. His piece is Silicon Valley's Quest to Live Forever. He joins us today from New York. David Sinclair is with us as well from Harvard Medical School, joins us from Boston, where he's involved in research and maybe soon therapy that has NASA interested enough to be getting right square in the middle of it, thinking about their astronauts on long, long trips to Mars. You can join us this hour. What do you think of Silicon Valley and the way it's coming at with so much enthusiasm, the idea of vast life extension, even making death optional? Does it sound to you like they're on the right track, like they might pull this off? Will we see Peter Thiel and Google founders living to be 150, 200, 300 more? David had lots of response already online here, and it's interesting the sort of range of things. I guess James says the hubris, the self-regard and self-obsession of these people who largely lucked into their wealth, i.e. Silicon Valley, I guess, is flabbergasting. Beyond that, the human species is already taxing the limits of environmental sustainability on our Earth. Hubris and self-regard, I guess they're in no short quantity in Silicon Valley, Ted Friend. These are people who have accomplished a lot and made a lot.
They have, and to your point earlier, I think there is a kind of like bracing and exciting optimism about the idea of since death is fundamentally something determined for us, depending on your worldview by God or evolution, is it something we can tamper with, we can change, we can push back against? And I found it interesting when I was reporting the piece, I talked to a lot of my friends and said, do you want to live forever? Just as a kind of casual conversation starter. Most people instantly said no. But if you sort of said, well, if you could live healthily and enjoy seeing your grandchildren or great-grandchildren for another 10 years. How about that? And they would say yes. Mm-hmm. And then I said, well, what about another 20 years? And then you sort of keep pushing it that way. And as long as people could be healthy and vibrant, they were like, yeah, I'd love, sure, why not that? So it's one of those things where it sort of ceases to be a bright line distinction once you just sort of keep adding another 10 years, another 15 years. And as long as people felt they could be healthy, which is the goal of the health spanners, they'd be like, yeah, I'd like to hang around for a bit longer. And if you also point out, if you go back in time and say, well, in 1900, the average lifespan was around 30 years, are you opposed to all the changes that we made since then that allow us to live to 70 or 80 or 90? Do you oppose vaccinations? Well, some people obviously do, but most people don't. Do you oppose sanitation? Do you oppose better dental care? I mean, people are in favor of those things, and this is really just an extension of that.
Well, look at that, the culture that is so focused on that in Silicon Valley. And we've got very practical questions for you, David Sinclair, as well, on the research you're doing. Buffalo, New York, Victor is calling. Hi, Victor. You're on the air with Tad Friend and David Sinclair.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of the moral, ethical question, I'm intrigued by the discussion of the NAD molecule. Obviously, it's been discussed that it's something within our body affecting our chemical composition. My question comes, with the potential treatments involved, is it something that's simply being added to our bodies, or is it boosting our body's ability to produce it, or where does it come from within us? If it's something that's already there, is it really that fundamental to alter the chemistry of us to help produce more of it to give us longer life?
David
and
Sinclair,
a better quality of life, to my understanding.
Yep, pick it up, David. I mean, this is the molecule with the capacity to repair DNA damage, and you hear Victor's question. Are you stimulating more growth of this molecule within the body? Are you introducing it in a pill? How does it work?
Good question. We know that NAD is formed by our bodies all the time. The problem is, as we get older, our bodies, for whatever reason we don't understand, make less of it. And what our approach is to make a drug that will allow the body to make more of it. We're supplying precursor molecules so that the body can immediately make more NAD. We're forcing the system to make more NAD. And when you have more NAD, your body thinks it's young again and actually fights disease and deterioration. And when we feed it to mice, we find remarkable restorative powers. We see that muscles become young again. The mice can run further. They even live longer in some studies. So we've got this essential molecule that is found in every life form on the planet. And we've just recently discovered that it is not just essential for life, but seemingly essential for our longevity as well.
Another question on this front. Colette in Abington, Virginia. Colette, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if NADA could help with current. If someone had cancer, for example, could NADA repair that also?
David?
Well, we tested in mice, and actually we think that NAD plays a very important role in protecting us from getting cancer. Tom, you mentioned NAD is important for protecting against DNA damage, which we know is a major cause, if not the most important cause for cancer itself. I wouldn't yet like to speculate the effects of adding NAD in a course of chemotherapy, for example, of a cancer patient. We don't know enough. And it may actually do harm. But we do know that if you give it to regular mice that don't have cancer, they are greatly protected against getting cancer in the first place. And that's similar to NASA's problem, trying to prevent the astronauts from getting cancer due to space radiation.
Tad, take us to Silicon Valley then. I mean, here David is working on this. They've got their own efforts underway. A lot of people are involved in it. Give us some of understanding of the people and, at this point, companies as well, or wings of companies that we know, who are really focused on life extension and maybe permanent life.
The main player in the field is an offshoot of Google, or Alphabet, a parent company called Calico, which is California Life Company, which was founded in 2013 with $1 billion in funding. It was basically the brainchild of a guy named Bill Maris, who was the head of Google Ventures, their sort of funding arm. And he thought his father had died of brain cancer when he was in his 20s, and it had a profound effect on him. And he thought, why do we have to die? Fundamental question we all ask ourselves when someone close to us does die. And he didn't just have the question that we all have. He had access to lots of money and smart people. So he went to the founders of Google and posed the same question to them. One of the founders, Sergey Brin, has a gene variant that predisposes him to Parkinson's disease. So he was like, that's a great question. And Larry Page, the other co-founder, said, terrific. Go to it. And they founded this company. And they're doing a lot of research that they were very reluctant to tell me anything about, but they're extremely secretive. But the fact of simply the fact that they Google announced this, we're going to solve death, $1 billion. It's a Google thing. Kind of gave it increased the fundability thing that I talked about earlier. And there's a lot of other companies that are starting and looking at various things like parabiosis, which is heterochronic parabiosis, which is often done in mice. Now is a hooking up essentially surgically an old mouse and a young mouse. And when you do that, after a matter of weeks, the old mouse gets younger and the young mouse gets older in terms of how its muscles and liver and brain look and how it behaves. And there's something called senescent cells, which are cells that sort of basically stop dividing and then emit a kind of noxious goo called SASP that seems to inflame the body in various unpleasant ways. And there are different companies looking at all these sort of different pathways of aging. The question that people run into is the point that David was making earlier when talking about NAD+, when he made the point that here's what it does in mice. Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is mice aren't humans, and every scientist will acknowledge this with frustration. They're a proxy for us that is a very inexact proxy, and one geneticist I spoke to said, so many times the mice have failed us, meaning we've cured cancer in mice dozens of times. We've made them live twice their normal lifespan by doing strange things to them. We've sprayed yellow dye called thiaflavin T on a tiny worm called C. elegans and made it live 70% longer just because you spray it with yellow dye that has no known biological impact except that for some weird reason makes them live longer. If you sprayed humans with yellow dye, they probably wouldn't live 70% longer. Mice don't get Alzheimer's disease. Mice don't have heart attacks. Mice have, you know, a bunch of different things that we don't have. And so it's hard to take it up the chain to humans. And, you know, hopefully some of these things will go up the chain, but Silicon Valley is facing the same frustration with, you know, the fact that mice aren't humans and humans are incredibly complicated that we all face in our daily lives.
Google's offshoot is not the only one working on this, but are they in the – you describe a battle between what you call the health spanners and the immortalists, I guess those who would extend the healthy lifespan and those who are actually looking for immortality here. Which camp is the Google effort in?
That's a great question because I mean – and if you can get them on the phone, they'll – refuse comment, but because they just really don't talk about it. My sense is it was founded by someone who was an immortalist, basically Bill Maris. Didn't exactly found it, but he was the guy, the impetus behind it, the man I mentioned. Mm-hmm. He wants us to live forever, and he told me, like, wouldn't it be a shame if, you know, I died a week before we figured this thing out? And that's – it is something to think about. I think most of the people who Google Calico has hired, the CEO and the leading scientists are all people who would fall into the health span category. So that it's a little bit of a perhaps bait and switch where it seems to be working more on trying to extend our life healthily from what I can gather than the idea of coming up with some magical all-purpose encompassing solution that will enable us to live forever. But you could argue that – and there's a guy named Aubrey de Grey in Silicon Valley who does argue that if we can simply buy ourselves 30 more years – if we can make enough small innovations, small to medium-sized innovations, and we get to sort of an average lifespan of 120, 130, then in that time we'll make enough other advances that we can keep pushing that back, and effectively we'll start to grow younger every year rather than older, and we'll achieve what he calls longevity escape velocity.
Longevity escape velocity. We talked with Aubrey Gray a couple of years back when he was out with his big book on this front. He was talking just a couple of months ago in Munich at a TEDx event there about what he sees as the reality behind aging. Now he's in Silicon Valley in a kind of a big voice there. But here's Aubrey de Grey earlier this year.
Aging is not a phenomenon of biology really at all. It's a phenomenon of physics, which is to say it's the same process in the human body or in any other living organism that it is in a car or an aeroplane or any other machine with moving parts, whether or not it's alive. It's the accumulation of damage that the machine does to itself throughout its operation as a side effect of the normal operation of the machine.
Ted, you've got others involved here, too. You've got, last fall, Jeff Bezos and Peter Thiel got involved with a company called Unity. They're looking to stretch lives to a span, you say, that Peter Thiel has pinpointed as forever. What's their approach?
Unity's approach is dealing with senescent cells, the thing I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. which are cells that have stopped dividing in the body up to about 5 to 7% of the cells in our body. Not only stop dividing, but start kind of turning out this noxious goo called SASP.
Which you call it the zombie toxin.
They call it the zombie toxin okay. because it seems to spread, infecting other cells and making them senescent and increasing inflammation throughout the body, which okay. leads to things like, chronic inflammation everywhere, possibly Alzheimer's, leading to atherosclerosis possibly, and certainly to arthritis. They are kind of they are not single-handedly going to fulfill Peter Thiel's wish and make us live forever. In mice, they say we can extend lifespan with these drugs that they're developing by 35%. I think they think we, can possibly – they say they're hopeful that when their first drugs come on the market in 7 years, that eventually they'll be able to cure about a third of the human diseases in the developed world. That's probably optimistic. And even the man I spoke with, who was a co-founder of Unity, he has a metaphor. Aubrey de Grey talks about the car a lot. You know, the human body's a car. We're mechanics. We can fix it and make cars run forever. Ned David, the guy I spoke with, his analogy is that, longevity research is basically a big tree. And he thinks Unity, along with a lot of other people like the parabiosis folks, mm-hmm. are branches of the tree. They're working on the branches, but there's no one yet working on the trunk. So even though he's excited about what they're doing, he's acknowledging that they still haven't found the master switch, because there may not be a master switch. It may be like 37 master switches, all of which are connected to one another.
Some in Silicon Valley are not so worried about their own body going on. It's their consciousness that they're interested in. We've talked with Ray Kurzweil about that here as well. He's at Google now. But Peter Thiel is working very actively on his body right now. And he, I think, if I got this right, Ted, he and others do this in part with infusions of the blood of young people. Do I have that right?
You have that right. It's a little bit vague whether he's actually still has ever injected himself with the blood of the young, or as some people like to say, young virgins. That he hasn't acknowledged that he's ever actually done that, but okay. He said he's very interested in doing it. He certainly did acknowledge that he was using human growth hormone for a while, but I think he's no longer doing that. He's definitely interested in, news he can use for himself. Whether or not he's doing, going out into the backyard and draining young virgins is a matter for public speculation, but he has not acknowledged it.
But that notion of the blood of young people somehow being appealing for those who want to live longer, I mean, that's got currency in Silicon Valley. You quote Bill Maris, the Google guy, saying this isn't about Silicon Valley billionaires living forever off the blood of young people. He says it's about a Star Trek future where no one dies of preventable diseases, where life is fair. But this blood thing has got currency. Is that just an urban myth in Silicon Valley, or is there something going on there?
No, there is. There are. I mean, you can, if you want, you can now pay $8,000 and go to a clinic in Monterey, California, and get young blood plasma, which is just, the blood of young people that you can get injected. And I wouldn't recommend it necessarily.
Sounds creepy.
Well, there's a number of possible issues with that particular blood. You could be 35 and be getting the blood of a 30-year-old in that system, and that may not help you all that much. But generally, the parabiosis, which is the thing I mentioned earlier, the idea of particularly heterochronic parabiosis, of getting older people getting younger people's blood, is an idea that's been around for centuries. A lot of doctors have talked about it. And it obviously it underpins things like the vampire myth. There is it's a sort of cultural idea that the blood, the thing that courses through us, may contain some magical solvent that will make us younger. The problem, the first modern, really exciting parabiosis experiment was about 13 years ago, 12 years ago, and it did show that young mice could rejuvenate older ones if you hook them up. The problem is no one has quite figured out what it is in the blood that does that. Is it a particular protein? Is it a carbohydrate, a lipid? Is it something from the liver of the young mouse? They don't know, and they're still working on it, and they all disagree.
This On Point podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
Hi, it's Tom. I'm glad you're listening to this On Point podcast. Really happy to have you here.
You know, a lot of people barely know podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. Here at On Point, we want to change that. All this month, we're inviting our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. Do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Silicon Valley's obsession with super longevity, maybe immortality, the high-tech super rich who want to make death optional. Tad Friend is with us from The New Yorker. He's been spending a bunch of time in Silicon Valley talking with very high-profile names and companies who are quite invested now in radically extending human lifespan, maybe indefinitely, maybe in ways that you might not consider. His piece is Silicon Valley's Quest to Live Forever in The New Yorker. David Sinclair is with us as well, professor, principal investigator, co-director of a lab focusing on the biology of aging at Harvard Medical School. He's right down in the science of this. NASA has recently knocked on his door to say, hey, can you help us keep astronauts from the rapid aging that goes on during spaceflight if we head out on trips as far as Mars, very long trips in space? You can join us this hour. Do you applaud this effort? Can you see why a Silicon Valley billionaire might want to live forever? Do you want to live forever? We're at 800-423-8255. Lots of interesting response here on Twitter. Hong says to us, as a graduate student in the biomedical field, I've seen many failures when we move from animal studies to humans. So duly noted, we know that's out there. Susie says, this sounds like a nightmare for the lower and middle classes and probably a dream to the 1%. Another edge the wealthy and very well-to-do will have over the little people. And then there's a whole range, Tad, David, of reaction to the whole idea. Paul says, at the risk of sounding self-deprecating on Twitter, he's writing, I don't think my life is significant enough that I should live forever. Silicon Valley billionaires may look at their lives differently. Mushroom Hunter writes to us, the actual prospect of living forever sounds like it would get boring. But Neil says on Facebook, bring it on. For 2,000 years, we've been promised immortality by Christianity, so I've been puzzled by all the hand-wringing when the issue is raised. Obviously, I'd like a shot at immortality. I'm tired of hearing ethicists gloomily catalog all the ways I might find immortality unpleasant. I'll happily accept being able to experience new existential hardships. I choose life. Lots of callers for the two of you. Kathy in Arlington, Massachusetts. Kathy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I'm thrilled to talk to you. It's a really interesting program. My first thought is that, to me, it's a dreadful nightmare to think of people living forever and the ultimate narcissism. I'm a healthy 76-year-old, and when I saw the movie Harold and Maude, I thought, when I'm 80, I'm going to pull a Maude and do myself in because I don't want to live to be decrepit. And now I've bumped that back to 85 with all the good health care and everything. But I still just have a real aversion to the idea of living longer and longer. And I think of my Italian mother-in-law who said that old people have to die to make room for babies. And that the whole idea of being careful of messing with Mother Nature and allowing for evolution to correct the ills of what we have now, I just really oppose the idea of anything beside. I do approve of trying to solve diseases and helping people live longer, but kind of within the normal range.
Well, Kathy, let me ask you, though, what if getting decrepit was not part of the deal? What if, you know, therapies and were developed so you would live long, but what we associate with old age and those declines, physical declines, didn't occur?
It just feels really selfish to me. I don't quite know how to explain it, but it's like, I guess I just basically believe in evolution, and so the idea that I should take more than my share of the future instead of allowing some young person to come along, and that I think I'm better than they are, just just feels wrong.
Kathy, we've got it. At 76, Tad Friend, it's interesting. You write directly about different views of evolution in Silicon Valley. Kathy's expressing kind of a traditional one there, but there's another view, Tad.
There is. I mean, I think that most scientists who I spoke to think that the reason we die is not a product of evolutionary intent so much as evolutionary neglect. In other words, insofar as evolution can be spoken of as having a purpose, which mm-hmm. is a whole other question, but basically we have developed so that we can pass our genes on. So the evolution's goal, quote-unquote, is to get us to the point where we can reproduce.
Once you've reproduced, it doesn't give much of a hoot about you as an individual human.
Okay, it's like, check please, you're done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is, you know, salmon have it where they spawn, then they die yep. instantly. We spawn and then we slowly fall apart. Other animals like sharks, Greenland sharks can live 500 years. Even the quahog clam can live 500, the record 507 years. So they're different
spans. Kind of crazy
spans
we make chowder out of that.
Can live we do. Wow. We end it.
Wow.
Yeah. But we we should be a little more respectful of that clam.
Yes.
Since it's close to Methuselah.
Yeah.
But the idea, I think, that the division is between people who think, you know, evolution, as Kathy said, sort of has a purpose and an intent, and we should give way to the young. We should allow new ideas. We should, you know, not despoil the earth. We should not get bored. We should not have Stalin in power for hundreds of years. Mm. That we need to sort of have people, young people come along and replace us and sort of carry on the way we always have. And other people think, well, you know, actually, no one has ordained evolution. Why don't we take charge of evolution? Why don't we become the master technician behind evolution and redesign ourselves to get rid of some of the problems?
She raises the phrase that this is the ultimate in narcissism. I mean, Silicon Valley masters of the universe are known to have a pretty high self-regard. How did you end up thinking about the sort of potential characterization of this as being driven by a sort of wild narcissism?
I think there's some of that behind it, certainly. I mean, I do think that the scientist I spoke to who talked about the narcissism and the idea that, you know, it's, you know, poor me, I have $3 billion and I only have a normal lifespan.
Yeah. I deserve more.
Yes, exactly. That's hardly fair. But I also thought, I mean, there was a guy I spoke to named Jun Yun, who's a doctor who runs a healthcare hedge fund, and he's one of the sort of leading figures behind the National Academy of Medicine's Longevity Challenge, which is a new thing where the National Academy of Medicine, which is a quite conservative, you know, establishment organization of doctors, really is looking into this and saying, like, let's have a challenge. Let's try to have a prize for people who will help us live longer and healthier. And they're putting at least $25 million into it, maybe up to $100 million. And Jun Yun told me, which I thought with admirable detachment, he's in favor. He believes we can become immortal. He thinks we can, you know, that thermodynamically we're computers. We can fix ourselves. We can get rid of entropy if we just keep putting new energy into the system. But he himself is not doing anything to try to expand his life. He's like, in other words, I am doing this as an abstract thing for others. It's a purely humanitarian impulse. I plan to die at the normal time. I'm not even exercising. I'm just going to keep doing my normal basic thing. Whereas most of the other people I spoke to, the Ray Kurzweils, Ray Kurzweil takes 90 pills a day, different kinds of supplements, including the one that increases the precursors for NAD+, a slightly different version than David Sinclair's, but he takes a pill called Basis that does that. And he's really eager to kind of get himself to the point where he thinks new technologies will come in, like nanobots that go through your bloodstream and take care of all the diseases and decay and replacement organs for organs that are failing, and then eventually being able to upload your brain into the cloud, connect to a neocortex in the cloud, and then upload your brain and then download it perhaps into other bodies.
We talked to him a few years ago when he was saying, look, this is on the horizon, and if you can live long enough, Ray Kurzweil was saying, you'll be able to grab onto the kind of immortality train, though you note that he and Aubrey de Grey have a backup plan if all this doesn't advance as quickly as they hope, that when they die, they'll be frozen in liquid nitrogen with instructions left to reawaken them when science has finished paving the road to immortality. David Sinclair, you work on this in a hands-on way. What do you make of Kathy's complaint or her plea saying, you know, people shouldn't live so long. They should give way to the young. you're working like crazy to help people extend their life. What are you thinking when you hear that?
It's a common reaction, and I'm pretty sure it was the same gut feeling that people had when we invented antibiotics or invented the right flyer. Speaking to how Silicon Valley is characterized, I don't think it's just a selfish thing. If we go back to the Wright brothers, for example, the analogy is that we've just learned how to fly, but for aging. And go back to those days. I'm sure people were saying, "Oh, it's hubris to think that we could be flying. Humans are not supposed to fly. It's not in our nature. Evolution never said we should be able to fly." And the wealthy were the ones that benefited from that initially, but it became democratized. So now we take it for granted that we can fly across the country, and everybody can take advantage of that. And I see the same course here with aging research. It will be large companies, it will be the wealthy that push this technology forward, but eventually everyone will benefit, every family. And so I don't see the selfishness being an issue here. I think that it's a necessary part of all new technologies. As for being able to have a benefit to society, I think what Kathy is missing is that what we're doing is very similar to all medical research. I'm here right in the middle of Harvard Medical School trying to save lives, trying to make people be free of diabetes and cancer and Alzheimer's. The only issue here is that we might have a much bigger effect than any single treatment alone.
Looking here, Ted, in your piece, you're quoting Aram Sabeti, 30-year-old founder, tech company called Zero Cater, Silicon Valley, says, "The proposition that we can live forever is obvious. It doesn't violate the laws of physics, so we will achieve it." Patrick in Portland, Maine. Patrick, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. It's a really interesting conversation, and I think one of the things that struck me most was that there's a lot of discussion and a lot of energy around preserving our physical body, but what if we could preserve just our memory, our mind, our consciousness, our self-awareness, upload it to some sort of, hard drive with so many terabits of memory, and we can experience the world around us using computers and optical, mechanical means rather than, or maybe inhabit another creature for that matter. I mean, all this, and I love the fact that we're extending life. I think that's a really important factor, but I think that, the idea of living forever seems, I think we're all narcissists to begin with anyway, not just the rich, but I do feel that if we could just, look at this more or less from, there is a life, there's an end to life at some point, but I think because we want self-preservation, we're all narcissists, we unlike a lot of creatures, you mentioned the clam. I mean, there's no self-awareness there. And, so to preserve my individual consciousness, I think it would be, if I could exist in something else, still be conscious, I think that would be great.
Even maybe a machine. Hey, Patrick, our time grows short. Let me get it right there. Tad Friend, what portion of those in Silicon Valley you talked with, are in these different camps? I mean, they want longer life. What qualifies? Is consciousness qualify? Even if your consciousness is sustained by machinery that's not your human body, or how big is that camp versus the camp that says, no, I want my body and my mind to go forward?
Well, I came up with names for the two slightly different avenues to pursue toward immortality. I call them the meat puppets, which is sort of the Aubrey de Grey approach, where we can stay in our bodies and live forever within that. And
just
then there's
keep refurbishing our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Just keep tuning them up and trading out and kind of going in for tune-ups.
Yeah.
And then the RoboCops, where you sort of will become part Android or part avatar or part of the cloud. It's a probably overly schematic distinction, mm-hmm. because the real problem that kind of everyone faces is the fact that the brain does not make new neurons except in the hippocampus. So the thing that people run up against is what do we do with our brains? Most people think of a lot of themselves, whoever they are, as being, deriving from the brain. And to Patrick's point earlier about transferring your memories to another body or another consciousness, the tricky thing there is that memory isn't, located in a specific space in your brain. It's not like you just – there's a little thing where you have a memory of your first kiss. Memories are derived from inputs.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on different triggers about the same fact will trigger different memories. Memories always are changing. They're plastic. They're sort of emerge from a web of synapses. And so it's very hard to like just take what they do when they call it whole brain emulation is the goal, where you can model the brain and then transfer it into some other vehicle. It seems like it's going to be difficult to bring all your memories with you. And I think you might be a super brain, superpower, but you might not be the same exact consciousness. And a lot of people would be say, okay, well, I'll take what I can get. Other people might think, you know what? That's not me.
It's interesting. You quote Ray Kurzweil, who's at Google now, saying it's a common philosophical position that death gives meaning to life. But Kurzweil says death is a great robber of meaning. It robs us of love. It's a complete loss of ourselves. It is a tragedy. Wow. When they fire up their big jets in Silicon Valley and get behind a perspective like that, what did you come away thinking, Tad? They may just pull this off 200 years, 300 years, indefinite life?
I wouldn't bet against it. At the same time as I was sort of at the narcissistic level for myself that Patrick was referring to, as we're all narcissists in a way, I was looking, what's the news I can use? You know, like, and I thought, well, I already exercise. I already eat pretty well. There's no little pill that I've discovered in the course of my research, with the possible exception of metformin, which is a drug that people with diabetes take that seems to extend life. There's nothing that I thought, oh, here's this one thing that I can take that's going to make me live even 20 years longer.
David Sinclair, you're going to have that pill for us within the lifetime of listeners?
Well, we're working on it, and some of us are already testing it out.
Does that mean you're taking it?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Wow. How are you feeling?
Pretty good.
Oh, boy. Here we go. Hang on to your hats, people. David Sinclair at Harvard Medical School. Thank you very much for being with us today, David. Wonderful talking with you.
Thanks, Tom, for having me on.
And Tad Friend, staff writer at The New Yorker. His big piece is Silicon Valley's Quest to Live Forever. Tad, you make it all quite vivid. We're really grateful for your work in bringing this all home. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Tad Friend with The New Yorker. Thanks for joining us. Long life to you. Long as you like. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.